We're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer. My guest for episode 212 is Graham Parker. His career started with a bang in 1976 with Graham Parker and the Rumor, who put out five albums by 1980, including perhaps his commercial Apex Squeezing Out Sparks, 1979, you're right now hearing Local Girls, a popular track from that album. He went solo in 1982, continuing his major label success with a steady stream of albums all the way through around 1996. By that point, he was touring mostly as a completely solo artist. I actually saw him live around that point. In 2012, Graham Parker and the Rumor reunited for two albums that has morphed into Graham Parker and the Gold Tops, a new similar soul-based band that has released another two albums. We will be discussing Lost Track of Time from the latest Graham Parker and the Gold Tops album, Last Chance to Do the Twist, 2023. Then Going There by Graham Parker and the Rumor from Mystery Glue, 2015, the second of the two reunion albums. Then She Wants So Many Things from Graham Parker's Struck by Lightning, 1991. And we'll conclude by talking about and listening to Between You and Me from Graham Parker and the Rumor's debut album, Howlin' Wind, 1976. For more information, please see grahamparker.net. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. To support my efforts and get my episode notes that break down the songs, give you the structures, the arrangements, in this case, even many of the chords, you can do that at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. So I played a little bit of Local Girls from Squeezing Out Sparks 1980 to Orient Folks, although I was having trouble figuring out, like, what is your big single, the big foundational song that everybody would know about? You seem more like a career arc. You know, a lot of people know about you, but I wasn't even really sure. I noticed what Chambermaid was the first. You mentioned it as in your book, The Thylacine's Lair. Your fictionalized version, you have a song called Shaky Knees, which I assume was your Chambermaid, the fictional equivalent of this was your early single, or no? Or is this...
It was called Knee Trembler, which is a term for having sex standing up. Yes, no, it's nothing to do with... No, it's just a jokey title. The Thylacine's Lair is fiction, of course, but based on a lot of experience. Now, Local Girl, I don't have hits, really. I mean, a few minor ones. I'm an album artist, and that kind of became clear to me when my first single came out from Howling Wind, which was actually Silly Thing. I remember it being Silly Thing, and it had a B-side that wasn't on the album. And I heard it on Radio 1, which was the where you had to get played to have hits in Britain. And I heard it and I thought, for crying out loud, it sticks out like a sore thumb, or it disappears like a sore thumb. It sounds like Delta Blues. It sounded like, and it's not, it's a really catchy pop song, but I think the combination of me and the Rumor made our songs sort of unhittable in a way. And I was like, yeah, well, I'm an album artist. It's a whole story on every album. So I just, I do what I do. There's no choice. I write what I write and I record what I record. But Local Girls would be one of the most popular, and a lot of things from Squeezing Out Sparks. Don't Ask Me Questions is up there as well. When a lot of people don't know who I am, they hear that and they go, oh, I know this. I've heard that quite a lot from people who've never heard me, and then they hear me play it and go, oh, yeah, I know that song. Everybody knows that. So there's a few songs that just got that kind of, you know, amount of people hearing at some point or another throughout my career.
Sure. In America, I picked up on you sort of concurrently, sort of retroactively in the early 80s with the, you know, Get Started, Start a Fire and some of the other, you know, Lunatic Fringe songs like that, you know, of course, hearing them in the album context. But in any case, we want to get pretty quickly to, you know, this is 25 albums later from when you started to the new album. The song is called Lost Track of Time that you had picked off the album Last Chance to Do the Twist. Do you want to say a little about where you're at with this album before we hear it in full, and then we'll talk more?
Well, Lost Track of Time is kind of interesting to me, like Sun Valley, in that I had those songs a decade or more ago, but couldn't quite pull the trigger on them. Sometimes happens it that kind of rhythm can get very stodgy, especially in my hands, because I tend to write, you know, two verses, you know, a song like Lost Track of Time, it's going to get plotty if you do two verses. And I found different ways of arranging that song and Sun Valley, which I've recorded, you know, three albums since writing those songs, but not completely finishing them. And so what's interesting to me about Lost Track of Time is the arrangement, which I do one verse and then I get out of it while I'm winning and do a bridge.
The bridge is so very early in the song.
Yeah, that's right. And it sounds like the song is about 5 minutes long even then, but that doesn't make it, you know, sludgy or draggy, because every bit is just in the right place. So I found a few ways to unlock a few of these songs that could have gone by the wayside. You know, sometimes they do. They just disappear. But I knew there was something in that song. And I love the big crunchy Keith Richard kind of chord opening to it. Really like that. It's one of those kind of songs that could fit in with that area of music, like a Stones big fat thing, you know. So, boy, it worked. We nailed it in a few takes and off we go.
Yeah, so very distinctive. I'm sure that riff has been used somewhere before. In fact, when I was trying to play along with it, it seemed like I'm just going to E to A, but the A is slurring up from, you know, just playing sort of the bar chord version of A, but slurring up, you know, so one of these natural things you find with your fingers. It's just amazing that you had not stumbled on this particular riff before. It's such a...
I have variations of it. There's a ton of variations where you hammer off of the whatever note it is, the A with a boom, blad out, you know, that hammer off thing that's very hammer on and off, sort of Keith Richardy, like, you know, basically you think of Brown Sugar or something, you know. It's sort of embedded in a lot of R&B and soul in a way. I think Keith took it and nailed it, you know, and we've all stolen from Keith if we're any good. Anyway, I think my engineer said that's a bit like Honky Tonk Woman. Well, it's a very slowed down Honky Tonk Woman, but it's got that. If you think of the chords, the opening chords of Honky Tonk Woman, it's got that pause to it where it kind of hangs there. It's slow and lazy, but intense at the same time, which I do pretty damn well on an electric guitar.
And then moving for the verse into, okay, it's been going EA. We're going to move to C sharp minor, you know, to kind of throw things, thread the needle. It's not like exactly the relative minor, right? It's not E to G sharp. It's not any thought about. Is that, again, just something you're finding with your hands is the most comfortable place? Or did you have this melody in your head sort of before you found?
The bridge section where I go to the C sharp minor, and then there's an A and a D, and then an A where you don't expect it. Once I thought, I guess, of not doing another verse, wait to, you know, do another verse later. But, you know, it just pops out at you. It's basically messing around on the guitar. That's basically a lot of what I do, sit and mess around and hum bits of melodies until something goes, hold it, stop there, okay, try that again, and elaborate, and next thing I know, great, I'm on it, and now I'm ready for a solo, which went over the same, I don't know what chord, different chords, or I can't even remember now, but there's so many parts to the song, but it all makes total sense, and that just comes from a hard graft. Songwriting is hard graft. I remember an interesting story, actually, talking about that. There was this guy, it was from the 70s, I don't know, someone who was trying to write songs in bands, and he lived above Jackson Browne's flat apartment, wherever they were, you know, in the early days. And so one day he wakes up, this guy, I remember reading this distinctly, and he's hearing Jackson Browne tinkering around in the morning, breakfast time kind of thing, on the piano. And he keeps working at it, keeps doing something. So this guy, instead of going out to do anything, just lays there, gets stoned and lays around all day. And Jackson Browne, you know, does a certain amount on this song, and then he goes out and has some lunch, comes back, carries on again, and it's still in well into the evening when Jackson Browne is now finishing the song. And the guy said, well, I can't be a songwriter. I mean, there's some magic trick to it. And then he thought, oh, maybe it's hard graft. It's like, yeah, lights go off. Yeah, that's what it is. It's hard graft. Some songs, you know, yeah, when I'm working very hard on different songs, one song might pop out from nowhere, complete almost.
Mm-hmm.
But that's being in that tunnel of creativity. You got to be there to get there. It's a work process. I call it a job. With inspiration, of course.
So that's interesting. You were referring to, I was thinking that what is counted as the chorus, this is what I thought the bridge was, 117.
Now when you lose track of time, you know it's all on your watch. It's like a job that you botch for somebody else, and you let yourself down, you're gonna let it down too.
Call it a bridge, yeah. So that comes right after the first verse. As far as I remember, yes, instead of going to another verse. Yeah, that would have made it drag, you see, I think, going to another verse, which is a typical thing, and then you go to a chorus, and then you do a bridge, and then you come back to a chorus or back to a verse. So I was flipping things around, and it seemed to totally save the song and bring it as something I had to do.
You introduce the chorus before that bridge comes out, and even the verse itself, given that it's so slow, it's like a double length. I sat there thinking of you, blah, blah, blah. So I walked down to the drinks machine. So, I mean, it is kind of like you have two verses packed together. But still, the whole thing is very concise.
It is. Yeah, I go to the chorus, which is only a few bars, whatever, four bars, and then into the bridge. Mm-hmm. And from then on, I could mix things up. It all felt very natural from then on. And I'd found the keys to it, really.
And in the chorus, this answering electric guitar, I just lost track of time. So is that your riff, or is that the lead guitarist in the Gold Tops coming up with something, or?
That's Martin's riff for the solo, which I played, the lead solo.
I figured, okay. That's been interesting that you've been, with the rumor, you have two lead guitarists and you who is a lead guitarist, right? And you started as a lead guitarist. I was reading that you were in like a kind of a hippie prog band or something when you started playing lead guitar. So, I mean, what's that? Like, we're going to have three people that could solo potentially.
Well, yeah, but I mean, Brinsley and Martin were the ones I usually left it to for the soloing. There was a few songs. Mercury Poisoning, I played the lead on that, and that wasn't even an album track, you know. But mainly I left it to them. But since then, there's been albums I've made. Deep Cut to Nowhere, for instance, is one of them. Don't Tell Columbus, another one. They're kind of mid-period things. I think they were on Bloodshot Records, weren't they? Something like that. I don't know. I've lost track. Maybe Razor and Tie. But I was playing all the lead on those records, and I was playing bass as well. I got into this thing of recording in America and playing all the guitar parts myself and just, you know, using a drummer and a keyboard player. I'm no good at those things. So I've had a lot of experience, and my solos don't sound like Martin.
Let me insert some of the solos here. It seems like when I hear you play lead guitar like that, that it is because you're a singer. And so you're playing with your hands like you would be singing. They're very melodic parts. It's not doodly 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 doo. It's not the lead player thing.
Yes, I really like solos that are based on the melody of the song. They come off of it. They bounce off of it with horn sections and with other instruments, with a sax solo. On this sax solo on it, one of the songs on the Last Chance of the Twist, It Matters to Me. I sort of base it on singing to some degree. That is my style. Brinsley would come up with his own take on it, and Martin often come up with their own take on it. But generally, when I solo, I'm trying to play around with the actual melodic structure of the song, the singing part. So I'm a kind of guitarist when I play lead who takes it from the vocal, my vocal style in a way. But yeah, it's always good to have people like Martin who sound like Martin Belmont. Brinsley Schwartz sounds like Brinsley Schwartz. These people are always, you know, on the albums. They really do have their own sounds, which always meshed. And my rhythm sat right in there with them all the time. We had a great rapport without even thinking of it. You know, we didn't have to discuss a great deal, really.
A couple more of the musical gestures here. Of course, you know, toward the end, because the clock's just stopped. And everybody stops for a second. This seems like pretty typical of, we're going to articulate, tell the story through the music that's being reflecting the lyrics here.
Oh, I love a good stop in a song. I love a good dead stop. Yes.
And what is your thought about, you know, when you have backing vocals come in at the end, it's pretty much just a light unison chorus. I don't think that you stack the harmonies or had the choir come in. It's just, what's your reference there?
Lost Track of Time, I'm doubling my vocal.
Okay, so it's just you.
The girl singers aren't on this song. When we did it live, they were. We did a short tour. But I just thought it's the perfect, like a lot of those Stonesy songs as well. Jagger doubled the vocals a lot. And so did a lot of 60s records. Of course they did. And I don't do it very much, but I should do it more, I think. But there's some songs where I thought, I've got to try doubling the vocal here. And it fattens it up. And the vocals, the two vocals, I don't do them with a computer. I do everyone individually so that they rub against each other a bit. It's not perfect. And I always like that with old 60s records where I didn't know what they were doing. I didn't know the technology, you know, what it was, a double vocal. But I could feel it. You could hear the other vocal by the singer slightly rubbing there. It kind of puts a seed in you for the future. One day, there I am doing the same thing.
And then you like your fade outs. I know the next song and this song both have fade outs, so you can continue. I mean, again, you resolve, you get to the bridge so quickly, but yet the whole song is a reasonable length, is 3:45. So you can make that outro be the thing that sits in this and lets you really sing along for a while.
Yeah, I always thought that the song itself, by the style of it, was going to be about 5 minutes, but it sort of felt like that playing it on acoustic guitar at home. But once we'd done it with the band, it was like, what's the time of that? So as you say, was it 3:45? And I'm like, yes. If I get songs under 3 minutes, every time I said to Tuck, my engineer, how long is that song? And he'd say, oh, that's 2 minutes. So I was like, yes, stop being such a blowhard. Stop being so windy, for God's sake, which I'm very capable of. Which is okay in some songs, but I definitely prefer things to be a bit more concise these days. It suits me better.
Well, and in this one, as the fade happens, as you're starting to repeat things, the guitar, Martin's part, varies a little bit, like maybe doesn't just do the same riff, but adds a couple notes. But still, it's not like he goes into a solo. The bass gets a little more busy, you know, like, let's do a run. He's been so disciplined the whole song. What is your method in terms of how much you're coaching the rhythm section to, like, keep it down? I mean, most of it is, this is just straight Charlie Watts, but occasionally he does a fill into the snares, you know, just little things here and there.
Well observed. I mean, it's the musicians. The thing with these guys is they just play like that when they're required to. And they understood that from my songs. I don't need to say much about that. You know, I let the bass player do some movement when he wants to, and the drummer do some movement when they want to, because you need those bits of variation for people like yourself who are really listening and taking stuff in. And I like it that some people of mine are quite aficionados at what music is. They can take in that kind of, those details, it just spark of all kinds of interest in their way. I suppose a lot of people need something more dramatic, like hit records or something. They need something, they can't follow something as simple as this, which has those variations which make a lot of difference, but don't make a lot of difference. So I really don't have to say much to these musicians with the particular material that I've been coming up with for the last couple of albums.
Now, lyrically, and though this is kind of a feel-good song, this is like Depressed in a Hotel Room, which I would think is sort of the most common song or the easiest song to want to write as a touring musician, because you're so often in there. Yeah, any thought about why this one? I mean, you're very vividly describing the details of the air conditioner and the going to the drinks machine, and then connecting this to missing the people at home and potentially this, I don't know, what's this message of, am I wasting my life touring? It's such that I'm not with you at home. What's the sentiment there?
Well, yeah, you've described it well. It was, you got the key word, I suppose, vivid. The lyrics are vivid. They are a story in themselves, every verse is. It's not just, oh, I'm so lonely, baby. I wish you were here. It's not like that. It's a vivid description of a cheap motel with the rock hard bed and the air conditioner that makes a racket and the drinks machine. It's like, what's wrong with it? There's nothing here, you know, and the smell of smoke. All of those things, just, that's just the way I write. I call it sort of theme association, more than, it's like word association, but it's theme association. What is the theme of being in a cheap hotel? And you know you got a sound check in like 2 hours and you got to sit there and there's nothing around you and there's an office block view outside. For me, it's like falling off a log to write a description of that, to a vivid description of what that is like. So it's not just a maudlin song about I miss you, baby, you know.
Well, it's hard to make a cool song that talks about Wi-Fi in it, you know, that mentions any current technology. It seems like, oh no, don't put that in. But, you know, you've already established, we're just describing in a mundane way, here is the thing. So it's
that's a mundane thing, yeah. But back in the, whenever I wrote that, the Wi-Fi was much more dodgy in motels. And it's like, God, I'd like to, this fucking Wi-Fi is, but this Wi-Fi is nonsense. You know, what's going on here? Because the early days, they got it together a bit more since then, even the cheap motels usually.
And you add some dramatic, the action of the brain is seizing up. I'm dead inside, but I can still feel something deep in my heart. If I peel away, there's a glimmer of something, you know, sort of adding action to a basically static scene. Interesting.
Yeah, well, at that point, you know, you've either got to get down to the venue and sit in some lonely room as the sun, melancholy sunlight peeks in somewhere and in the backstage, and it's as miserable as the hotel, really. You know, you've got to get out and do that or hang yourself from a lighting fixture. So I generally think that the best bet is to go and do your work. You know, it turns out better for everyone in the end, really. You don't want to cause a fuss, do you?
Let's get the second song out there. A much cheerier song going there from your second reunion album with Graham Parker and the Rumor, Mystery Glue, 2015. All the original members, right? I mean, is this...
Everyone there.
Yeah, amazing. Can you say a little about where you were at and this swing song, how this came together?
It was a very eclectic bunch of songs on that record. There's a song called Slow News Day, which really is obviously a sort of Kinks retread. It's very much that. This song going there, I thought was reminiscent in its groove to Silly Thing from my first album.
Yeah, it sounds rather 70s, especially putting that lead guitar noodling on the riff. Like, that's like a a pop song, Bread. I don't, you know, from the 70s, I very seldom hear that kind of thing now.
I don't know why the lyrics came to me like that. I am with my son and daughter, cross the water, just one thought of going there. There's a blue horizon, that's not surprising, that is rising over there. Oh, 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 oh. And then it goes to this very interesting bridge that I love a lot. Another C sharp minor thing, possibly. Don't know. I haven't played.
E flat minor. I charted. I don't take the time to chart most of these, but these were so fun that it's just, oh, it's easy to pick the chords out. I can figure out.
Yeah. Very good. You do. You're saying the right things. Because some of the chords I see written down for some of my songs on the internets and the Googlers is like, what were they thinking? So you're closer to anybody so far.
Well, I didn't know. Did you use a capo on this? Because when I was playing along, it seemed like a little easier because the whole thing is in G flat minor.
My goodness. I don't know. There might be a capo on the first fret. I don't know. I don't know what key it's in. I haven't played it since we recorded the record.
Okay.
Yeah, it was one of those things. That is so perfect. Leave it. Don't do it again. Don't do it live. And let's face it, me and the room have a lot of choice of live songs when we were touring. So it was just one of those anomalies that came out. And I do love it a lot, the composition, the swing, and the acoustic style I'm using where I stop and actually play down, 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 down.
Yeah.
I'm playing those as well. And the bus bell, when you press the stop on your bus, on your English bus, it used to go ding, ding. Now it sort of goes, bah. But in those days it was a ding, ding.
Ah, so this is where that.
Steve is doing that on the cymbal there. Bing, bing. I think there's a couple of bing, bings. This is the song, right?
Tell you that it can't be done. I'm not listening, I don't care. Oh, I'm with my son and daughter across the water. Just one thought I'm going there. Ooh, there's a blue horizon. Not surprising that it's rising over there. Together going there.
Yeah, so this very kind of goofy intro with the, you know, over the
Brinsley doing the slide, I think. Yeah, Brinsley on the slide. Yeah. Yeah, he came up with that, and I thought, that's it, Brinsley. That's very pop, very 60s, yeah.
And you mentioned the little chimes. You didn't mention the tap shoes or whatever.
Oh, the tap shoes came in.
That. Like, I can see, like, do not try to do this live. Nobody wants to hear you, you know, somebody. You have a very indulgent audience to, like, and now we're going to do the tap part.
You know, tap dancing bit, folks. Yeah, come on. Get jiggy with it. Well, there you go. You know more about the song than me now. I must listen to it again. I just kind of blithely said, I like that one. It's catchy. Throw that in there from that album, which is a kind of a bit of an underserved album. It was a really good album, I thought, Mystery Glue.
Well, yeah, and more overtly soul. You know, I was trying to describe what your style is to people, and it's a style that I'm very influenced by. So, you know, sort of basically Dylan-esque in that there are lots of words. And that means, and you're playing mostly with an acoustic, or even if you're not, it's chordally based more than riff based. But within that, then you could be very eclectic, such that I think the genre that I usually have to go by is singer-songwriter. Like, okay, well, what does that mean? You know, that could be the Dave Matthews Band. So it's a singer-songwriter playing against a really funky section, or can be a very, you know, rockabilly, or like just on one of your albums, you might go between just all these references to past eras and genres, but it's still just you and your guitar and focused on the lyrics. So it's, you know, it's not defined. I guess adding the rumor in it makes it more, oh, this is the soul band.
Well, we had a lot of that because Howling Wind is basically a kind of blueprint for everything I've done. I mean, I've swayed quite a way off of that, but essentially it's very much the roots, I call it roots music for want of a better term, Americana or something. It comes from soul. It comes from the folk idioms that Dylan brought, dragged into the future and made what people thought of as folk actually into pop songs, with a lot of weight to them as well, that was modern to the times and not, you know, sitting on the porch writing songs about the injustices of the world in very bland, simple terms. Dylan did it in a whole different way a lot of the time. And sometimes he was also quite literal. But, you know, there's that influence. And a lot of the soul influence, well, that's from when I was 14 or 15. And yeah, you know, we found out a lot of the white pop bands, the beat music bands, they were getting it from American black music. They were influenced, you know, Twist and Shout, Please, Mr. Postman. The Stones were doing Chuck Berry and, you know, Sonny Boy. Whatever they were doing was all blues. It was all a lesson. It was all a great lesson when you were a kid. But growing up in England, as I was, you know, age 12, and the Beatles come along, you didn't see it coming. And suddenly you've got your own music, and then you start to learn where it comes from. It doesn't take much to learn where it comes from, because then you start hearing Chuck Berry on the pirate radio or something. It's like, oh, for goodness sake, yeah, oh, Carol, they're doing this Chuck Berry guy, aren't they? Or, you know, it was all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of in my DNA, really, as you could say.
With the rumor, either with the original iteration or getting these guys back together, are you taking advantage of the fact that some of them are legitimate songwriters? Were you trying to collaborate in new ways, or was just still, this is the batch of songs you have, and these are the people that you're going to have back you on this one? But it just simplifies things to just, you're bringing in the songs and see what they do with it.
And trying to get them to understand where the song is coming from, because just a guy on an acoustic guitar is sometimes hard for even great musicians, because they immediately start thinking of themselves and what they'll do. And I have to rein them in a bit. I'd have to rein the rumor in a bit, because they're so creative and they can play all over the place on any song you like. They can really get wild on it, as they did in the earlier days. And we were younger, and it was like, yeah, fast, faster, faster. Just elaborate, go mad on it. You know, so it's letting them come up with their creative ideas. But there are some things, like the song I mentioned, Slow News Day, where I hummed or played on guitar the entire bass break that happens on that song to Andrew, and said, try this. Here's the notes. Play it. And Andrew is the most creative bass player I've ever heard, let alone worked with. He was into it because he knew it was a good part. He played it, you know, just as I'd showed him. There's things like that, but with the rumor, you know, you give him a lot of latitude. You know, you let Bob Andrews play a lot, because he plays a lot, and because it's quite brilliant and very, very exciting. And it's the opposite with the Gold Tops, the keyboard. I want to be much more subtle, very different. And for that, with the Gold Tops, there's Geraint Watkins, who has a beautiful, sort of rich country pop star. I mean, there's a lot of things he can play, but he keeps it very understated. And that works better for these kind of songs and for me in general. At this point in time, who knows what's next? I mean, I don't plan these things ahead. I might be writing a few things quite a lot of the time, and I'm sort of ruminating on what to do, but I never know until I've got like six songs, right? Basically 4 to 6 songs. And I think, okay, there's a feel going on here. They're all different, but there's a feel. And that's when I start thinking about the right musicianship to back it. It's a process. It's a long and winding process.
Let me play a couple chunks here. The transition between what I'll call the first and second verse, which is very sudden.
Can't be done. I'm not listening. I don't care. Oh, I'm with my son and daughter. Across the water. Just
the fact that there's no, I would think that I'm not listening. I don't care. Bum, ba, da. But no, we're at the second verse already. You know, just
that's it. Yeah, we got the flow. Once you got the flow and the groove, you know, it's there. It's all there.
By contrast,
looking at sunset, cherry red, trim that sail, boy, sail ahead. Pick up the wind and head right there instead.
So when you finish the chorus, since we've, you know, switched to some different chords, we're going to go back to where we started, the F sharp, and sort of da, 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 so that you can then have a clean plate. We're back to where we started, so you can do your little acoustic walk up again. Yeah, any thoughts about like where we're going to have a gesture like that? There could be a big lead splash, wah, 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 but you don't know. We're just going to play the chords for a measure to just reorient you, as opposed to just what you did between those verses. Like, let's just get on with it.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know the song better than me now, that's for sure. I must listen again. But once you get a take going like that, and it's like, okay, that was a pretty good take. Let's do it now. We can, and we nail it. It just, the flow of these things is just magic to me. It's just, being in the studio and you hear that a good take, you know what you got there.
Yeah. So in terms of like, how many measures am I going to put between things? Is that something you just come in with and you have the exact structure and this is what the band is going to play? Or is it really, let's play it with the band a few times and see? I'm finding I'm playing with a new band now. And okay, I thought I was just going to do my transition riff and we're going to go into the next part, but maybe I should sit on the chord a few more measure and, you know, another 4, another 8 to let people, because we have talented people who want to do riffs.
Basically, my songs are about 95% when I put them onto a cell phone on acoustic guitar, or I've gone into a little studio and banged them down. They're basically about 90 to 95% there. But once you're in there with a band, there are things that you need to adjust. I had the idea for, say, on the new record, like the first track, the Music of the Devil, to have this spooky keyboard. That was there when I went in, but I wasn't sure how long the measures were going to be. So there's, you sort of run through it and say, that was good length. And I try to be in visual contact with the musicians. I might be in a booth, but I try to be in visual contact and give a quick nod that we're coming back into a verse or some kind of stress or a bridge. There's always a lot of, okay, and I start playing and I'm singing it live.
Oh, so this lead vocal is the one that was sung with the band, that you were able to isolate it enough from your guitar.
Yeah. I've been doing live vocals as much as possible, and that's pretty much most of the time throughout my career, from the Mona Lisa Sister onwards. When I said, look, I don't want any more of these producers. I don't want it. They're going to make it sound like the 80s. I think the 80s are over, even though it's 87. They should be over. Enough of that. So I became the producer and got a great engineer, and that's what I've done ever since. In that sense, I can call the shots and cover the bases I want to cover. That's really what I've been doing all that time since the Mona Lisa Sister, because I thought, well, I did a good job on that. And it's not an 80s sounding. It's not a big, giant snare drum sound.
Right. The way of processing now is not the way of processing in the 80s. My last album that I could refer you to has a little too much, even though it's basically an acoustic album of this sort of singer-songwriter variety, has a little too much pitch correction that sounded okay when I was playing with a big three-piece electric guitar thing. But now in this exposed, you know, that's the studio standard of, you know, this could work on the radio, means you got to use at least the pitch correction to fix the, at least the nasty bits. But it seems like you are not the acoustic guitar is going to bleed onto my vocal track and vice versa. And there's nothing that can be done about that because it was recorded live. You're not going to be able to fix anything rhythmically or pitch wise about the vocal. It's just that's the way it is.
You can drop in for a piece with both acoustic and voice. And I've done that before, but very, very few times because it's about work. It's about hard graft. It's about getting your voice in shape. I'll even go sometimes to a rehearsal room on my own before we go into a studio to really open my voice up, to really belt it out, then take a day off and sing gently. It's a full-time job for me to make an album. It's not a chance thing. It's not, oh, I don't really know. I know. That's what I have to go in there with that thought. I know, because I can't rely on anybody else because no one else is as good as me. So there, take that to heart, baby. It's work. It's graft. And generally, I'm very successful. The thing, I'll tell you why I wanted to take it back to what you were saying, you know, singer-songwriter. That's what I am. That is what I call myself first. That's my job description. More than a live artist or a live performer. That's a very interesting part of it. And it's exciting for the audience and stuff, hopefully. But the main thing was, I got fed up with recording albums like the producers used to do, where they don't care about your vocal. It was always, even from Howling Wind, the vocal was the last thing. There was a scratch vocal till then. Even one album, I said, I love this vocal. I don't want to redo it. And the producer at the time, I think it was Jimmy Iovine, said, no, no, we can't use that. We can't use it. It was a terrible microphone, terrible mic. Well, it wasn't really. Now I realize it was a 58 mic, which a lot of bands used to sing through, even when they were recording. It just wasn't one of those big Neumanns that hang.
Right, that would pick up everything around, that you need an isolated vocal booth with just the vocal.
With a little 57, there was a lot of vocals in the 60s done on that. Sometimes it's a very dry, close sound. So what I treat it as now is the vocal, the singer-songwriter, the guitar and the voice is the most important thing. That's the most important thing. It's not the drum sound. It's not any sound. It's the singer and the songwriter, because that's what I am. So that is my reference point, ethos, as it were, for every album these days. And I hated what I heard sometimes when after 3 weeks of work and we got the tunes down, it's like, okay, vocals day, Graham. And my vocals weren't anywhere near as good as they could be. You know, I wasn't working enough then. I didn't understand it. I thought, just it's all about energy and emotion. It's not really. But it was effective, that intense vocal style at the time. But it's not what I want to do now. It wouldn't serve the songs right. But I hated it when you went back and you put the headphones on and now you're supposed to sing. It's like, oh, you and the engineer and maybe one of the musicians is hanging around. You feel self-conscious. You've got it on earphones.
Well, yeah, you're more likely to be out of tune because you can't hear exactly how well. Are you really hearing what you need to from the backing?
You're right. My pitching was terrible in those days. Terrible. I can hear it. I'm squeezing out sparks all over the place. But now my pitching is way better. Yeah, I'm not the greatest singer in the world by any means, but my pitching is way better because I'm playing live, because I've learned to try and capture that vocal right when it happens with the band and the acoustic guitar with the bleed over going on from the acoustic to the voice. Man, it gives it a feel every time.
Well, that's really interesting. I was wondering, because you do some sort of vocal riffs at the end, you know, the soul improv of exactly, whoa, you know, putting in the extra syllables. And I was, for me, like, it's easier to do that kind of, have that kind of freedom and improvisation if I'm not playing the instrument. But you're saying it's actually easier, or at least you were able to do it on here, that you're still going, chun, chuk, chun, doing a very straightforward thing with your hands while trying to disconnect your head and do something that floats off the rhythm and things like that, just like you do live.
That describes it. It's like the man with two or three brains. And that's what it feels like. I mean, it's always going to, how am I doing this? I don't know. Don't think about it, you know. So, yeah, I'm juggling all the balls at the same time. That's where you need to be prepared and ready to put it out there, because you're going to do more than one take usually. Sometimes you get a take instant first go through. But that's usually with something that's on like one chord or something. You know, it doesn't mean it's a bad song because it's on one chord. Huh? Hello, Sly Stone, Everyday People, you know. Aretha Franklin, Don Covey song, Chain of Fools. These are one chord songs. So I think you can get those with the first take more than the complicated ones where really people are also working on the fly like me, because I've got to remember some complex chord sequences, and they have as well, and they haven't lived with them as much as me. So that's a tribute to the kind of musicians I work with. And if they get something wrong, it's not so bad. They can overdub it. But me, I'm there with the live vocal and the live guitar.
I want to play a clip just from the end of the bridge where you go into the instead. You've had these really nice little chords, and now we're going to do, oh, it's going to be minor. It's going to be, yeah, any thought about introducing that at that point where I'm not even really sure that the lyrics, right? Look at that sunset, cherry red, trim that sail, boys, sail ahead, pick up the wind and head right there. Instead, like, what is there about, oh, now it has to get a little ominous because of...
Ominous, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's one of those things where you just know in a pop song, you need a surprise. Yeah, I think that's basically it. And it's it's ingrained from all those 60s pop songs where, you know, a band like the Beatles or the Kinks, they could go to places like that, but not in a ridiculously overt way all the time. In just a way that most people just feel it. They don't think, wow, that's weird. They just feel it. You know, you're obviously analyzing it, and that's a great thing. I like that. But people sometimes take the time out to say, what? Oh, that's a minor chord there, and figure it out. I love that, you know. I guess I'm just thinking of quick variety before you get boring. You know, panic, what do? Oh, minor chord, fantastic. It just opens the whole thing up again.
You don't have during that, even though it would be very natural for one of your two lead guitarists to do a big bend over that to, you know, add some tension that it's, you know, we're focusing on the vocals. And what is different about this than the first song is that the harmony vocals are very prominent. It's not just you. So is that Brinsley? Whose voice are we actually hearing prominently?
Well, Bob and Brinsley are the main singers. Together they work well. Steve Goulding joins in on some things in a little low harmony. Andrew can do as well. But basically, the voices you hear are combination of Brinsley and Bob. They've always worked well together. And I encouraged them on that particular album. I really did on Mystery Glue, especially on this song. They like that. They enjoy it. I just said, come on, go to town on it. Come up with some backing vocals here.
The group comes in on the go in there, which again is ridiculously sort of 70s goofy.
Yeah, it is. Exactly. I love that.
On that particular, you know, the part before that with the instead, you know, you got one prominent higher vocal. So when you demo, did you have the harmonies worked out, or you let them as the backing vocalists figure out what they feel natural to sing and how many of them want to do it?
I basically encourage, I just have to say it to Bob and Brinsley. I mean, I think when I was writing it, I'm sure I knew the scope for backing vocals on that particular song was going to be a great buzz for those guys to do, and it was going to work beautifully. So I would have been aware of that and probably dropping some hints as we're recording, like, you know, when we're doing quick run-throughs on sort of, and I can hear it. As it grows, I can hear it. And then I just have to encourage those guys and say, come on, we got loads of acres of space here to do this kind of stuff. And I think that was good about the album, that I just gave them a pointer and let them go. And that Mystery Glue has a good bit of that, I think.
Yeah, there's a little more playing around, some big drum riffs going into parts. I noticed piano and organ, at least in different parts of the songs. Again, with it's just, he gets as many passes as he wants.
Keeping Bob to one keyboard instrument is not easy. He's always going to say, can I try something about an organ on here? So I'm like, yeah, go on, Bob, do it. And of course, you've got it all the way through the track. You got two keyboards going. Sometimes it can thicken the stew too much, but I think on this album, Mystery Glue and Three Chords Good, the two keyboards are just sublime on everything. Bob's incredibly creative.
And was he playing the organ live with you and then like the piano, junk, are an emphasis that he has later or vice versa?
Oh, I would think he was playing the organ live on this one. It's a sort of thing that floats through it. It flows beautifully. An organ can flow beautifully with a live take. And a piano, I think that would be an added instrument there, the added keyboard.
All right, well, let's go back in time. I wanted to pick out one of the songs that I had listened to a lot when I discovered you in the early days from the Struck by Lightning album, 1991. I believe I got the cassette from the cutout bin. I loved picking up the 199 cassettes or whatever, you know. I always think of the things in the cutout bin as somebody thought this was going to do really well, but maybe the record company stuff didn't work out as well. You know, it did not become
then
a hit.
Then they dump it in the cutout bin, yeah.
But the first song off that, She Wants So Many Things, this is a 6-minute song. It's in 6/8, so we get a little different. And this seems definitely a solo tune in that it is the most Dylan-esque of the things that we're picking here. There are arrangement things, but it's you doing a lead guitar riff, not the lead guitarist that would play this intro riff and then have to be just sitting there doing nothing for a while. Like, anyway, can you say something about this era and this song before we hear?
Actually, it just popped in my mind. You were saying like a singer-songwriter song, very Dylan-esque. Of course it is. And I had the temerity, I suppose, thinking back on it, when I opened for Bob in 1991, we did a load of European tours and I was solo and he had a four-piece band. And I was opening my set with She Wants So Many Things. And a little bit cheeky, I think, perhaps. And also Garth Hudson is on there. Talk about the band. Garth Hudson's playing the accordion.
Oh, so he's the one really freaking out and filling up the space. Yeah.
Yeah, he's the one doing it, man. Yeah, and that was just let him go and do it. He'd do three different recordings and tell the engineer to put one on the left, one in the middle, one on the right. And we'd listen through and he'd say, stop right there, 1 minute, 35 and a half seconds. Take out 2 seconds of the middle take. There's some genius at work here. Wait a minute. He can keep a track of three different takes of accordion and pick out, 3, 5 seconds or 10 seconds of one that he doesn't like and pull it out and you'd never know about it. It was extraordinary working with him. We spent quite a bit of time just letting him go, man. Let him play on that accordion on that particular song. And I did some, it's interesting, I played a toy piano on it. On the down, 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 down. It was a toy piano. I think I'd used it even in the past or since then. In Dreamland Studios in New York State, West Hurley, New York. You just needed to add it. The pure momentum of the song is like a train. It just rolls. It's just rolling along very much like, I suppose, obviously a whole different ball game of brilliance and quality, like the Rolling Stone, where Dylan doesn't tell anybody much in those early songs. He wasn't like giving them the chords. He'd play it and they'd say, okay, that's all you need to know. And then they'd all play because a lot of his songs didn't have bridges. They just rolled in one thing and it was so perfect. You didn't need a bridge. You didn't need to elevate it. So a lot of those songs. But it has that feel to it. It's obviously it's Dylan-esque. That's why it was like cheeky of me to open my set, opening for Bob, doing that song.
She wants so many things you can give to her. She wants so many things you don't have much. She wants so many things you can deliver to her. She wants so many things all at once. Like a brick wall that'll keep her from crumbling, and a camouflage jacket to hide from herself in, and a system of worship like a powerful magnet that'll jar in the heathens, pick them up in a dragnet and pull them underwater till they all go stagnant. She wants so many things beamed in on a satellite, served up on a silver tray, a wasp and a parasite. She wants so many things, where you gonna find them all? She wants so many things, get up and run. She wants so many things, you're at a beck and call. You're the puppet, she pulls the strings just for fun. Like a blue ocean that's devoid of fishes, cause they're all on a table prepared in the dishes. Like an army of lieutenants all standing to attention, and a book about you where you don't get a mention. With a hand on a Bible, she's a right in your face. She's a living example of God's bad taste. With him for an ally, she can't be a heretic. For the heart's from a laboratory, spun from a synthetic. She wants so many things, robbed without question. The gardens of Babylon, hanging in festoon. A ship in the desert, your soul on the plate. She can't wait any longer now, don't make her wait. She wants so many things you can negotiate. She wants so many things, you feel the crunch. She wants so many things. Don't make her reiterate. She wants so many things all at once. Collection of clowns who are dragged up in public school, who dream up the rhythms that she dances in the disco to. They all surround her and yes her to death, with their hands on their mouths to hide their bad breath. And she lives in a fortress at the back of the project, and she'll let you in soon, but not now and not yet. She likes to see you immersed in greed, confusing what you want with what you need. She wants so many things, split up into atoms. She owns her crown jewels, but you can't get at them. She wants so many things, where you gonna find them all? She wants so many things, get up and run. She wants so many things, you're at a beck and call. You're the puppet, she pulls a string just for fun. So many things, you can't keep up with her. She wants so many things at the same time. She wants so many things, you can't keep it up. She wants so many things you'll never find, like 3 million shoes and a closet full of whips and 2 dozen hats, and then everyone fits in the kind of acceptance that needs a lobotomy that'll help you accept every single contradictory statement that hits you like a false nine gale and makes you go pale every time that you fail to bring home the bacon and to bring in the goods. Get the musk from the deer and the shell from the turtle and the gold from the fools and the shells from the sea. She says, load them in a caravan, bring them to me. She wants so many things brought to her feet. Cover every inch of the world in concrete. You better do it, it's only your fate. She can't wait any longer now, don't make her wait. She wants so many things you can give to her. She wants so many things you don't have much. She wants so many things you can deliver to her. Everything's attached to strings you can't touch. She wants so many things.
To focus on the least important element first, so the toy piano, I'll admit, at this time in 1991, when I would play with my band in college, none of us were the keyboardist, but we had a toy piano that we would bring around with us to gigs so that somebody could play it with one finger for like 2 songs. So I have an affection toward that kind of gimmick, but it is almost like a slide whistle or something. Like, it's not a dignified instrument.
No, it's not dignified. It's like a kazoo. I play kazoo, you know, quite a bit. You can't call it dignified, but it's extremely expressive. The toy piano is not very expressive, but it has a lovely clunky sound. You wouldn't want that on a real keyboard. It would be too good. It needs bang, dang, 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 and it's perfect. It's a great little keyboard for people who can't play keyboards. So it suits me fine.
Likewise, the lead riff that is doing, which is a very, you know, singable. If you had a lead guitarist that was doing that, they'd probably want to add a little slide, a little something extra, not just play doink, 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 doink. So this is clearly just you overdubbing yourself, right?
I think I played probably Telecaster Electric on the song, but I don't think I was picking out those notes. I think that was the job of the toy piano, as far as I recall.
Oh, okay. I thought the two were doing it together.
Oh, maybe I am. Maybe I'm doing it. If so, it's me on the lead guitar on that track. Yeah.
Before I actually sat down to chart this, I was thinking, this is really just the same chords over and over and over again. But no, there are actually distinct parts. That it's A-E-B-E, A-E-B-E for the intro, but then for the verse, it's A-E-B-A. You know, we're going to have something different just on the last line to keep it going. And then when you, this pre-chorus part, this B to A, is just designed to go on forever, potentially. That one of the times,
yeah, really, yeah.
You have five lines, four lines, you're ready for the chorus. But no, we're going to add and pull them underwater until they all go stagnant. We're going to add an extra one. And then it's eight lines, and then it's, I think, more than that for the last one. Oh, no, it's eight again.
The other interesting thing. Down, down, down. Right, those are the chords, the basic chords. So it starts on the A, even though it's, I guess it's in the key of E. But I play. This is what I play. I add this note. Can you see that? It's one, two, three, fourth fret. And it's the on the A string. No, D string. So I'm playing an A, but I've got that note there, and that sets up the entire feel of the song.
So it's an added ninth.
Yes, that is it a ninth either? See, I don't know what I'm doing. I still don't know what I'm doing, but it gives you the whole feel of the song.
Oh, sorry, it's a sixth. It's a sixth. It's an A sixth.
It's a sixth, is it? Down, down, down. That's what makes the song unique, and it makes me say, I've got to write this song. If it was just, it's kind of dead, but then it goes.
Sure. Oh, yeah. You got to have the little tension in there.
You got to have that, and it's quite pretty as well. It's got a lot of things going for it. You know, that's how it's done, kids.
So this is a song that, even though it goes on a long time, it's like the energy is about to burst. It's about to explode almost from the beginning, that it's just this very intense vocal. Any thought about how you're navigating the levels of, when am I going to jump to the high octave? When am I going to do, oh, now it's down, back down. You know, that you got to make it last 6 minutes. It's not just, we're going to state it and then we're going to open it up and then we're going to have a big solo and end it. No, it's got to be this perpetual tension here.
It has to be the perpetual tension, I guess. Yeah. And it's, to me, it's just playing the song quite a lot at home and then going, okay, good luck, Graham, and plowing into it and hoping by the shape of the lyrics that are coming up next, I'll find the appropriate emotional level and the appropriate twists in it so that it should be interesting all the way through, unless you're a dumbass, which most people are. But,
well, and then the climax is again, one of those stops. You're the puppet. She pulls the string, you know, that early you had one of those stops. Yeah, actually, this was in the earlier song. It was also in, right, the last verse. You know, this indicates,
oh yeah,
it's not the most climactic move one can have, but in the context, it breaks things up. You've been going so long, this momentum, that to actually have a stop there is quite jarring.
Yeah, there's all those lyrics, all that time I've gone through, and I still have to have a quick look up to the band, you know, if I'm seeing the bass player, if it was a bit, you know, and the drummer or whoever's playing, and sort of lift my head up and nod and go, whack, stop. You've got to act it out a bit. Just a little hint, but a lot of the guys make notes, you know, they make notes, but that's a tricky thing to keep up with, a song that long, and suddenly I'm going to stop.
You just got to conduct it. You got to just be, you got to just jump or something, because like they know it's something's going to happen.
That's right. It's a studio, but it's a performance. That's what I've been trying to do for, since the Mona Lisa Sister. It's a performance. It's a live performance, but it's studio. So you got to get the balance of the both worlds there, really.
So you haven't tried to teach this to live bands since. Is that the message I'm getting for this song?
What, playing live on stage?
Yes, with a band. I mean, I know you played the solo.
Yeah, with a band, you rehearse it, and they all know when the start's
coming. Oh, okay. All right.
But there's always going to be someone. It's usually the keyboard player who keeps playing. Well, I blame keyboard players for the ones who keep going. They're enjoying themselves, they're lost, and they don't realize the dead stop is coming up and everybody needs to stop. But live is live. You can, you know, it doesn't matter.
So this pre-chorus, I'm sure that's not what it is, but the B to A section, like a brick wall that'll keep people from crumbling, etc. This of various length. So again, I said five the first time, 8 the second time, 8 the third time. I'm looking at my notes. 10 the fourth time. And the 10th, I think that's when you really, the tension is really like you're in a mental institution at this point, because, you know, you're expecting after 4 or after 8, finally give us the relief. Go into the chorus. No, we're going to just keep doing this. And the gold from the fools and the shells from the sea. She says, load them in a caravan, bring them to me. I mean, this is the real climax of the song. It's not that that stop was only 3 minutes in. This is the place where, you know, it's going to go off the rails of anyway, to the point of, I guess, yeah, there's still more. There's still another chorus after this. Oh, and then you actually repeat an earlier verse that like, oh, that this wasn't long enough. I'm going to repeat some lyrics earlier.
I think I repeat the first one again or something like that, just to remind you where you are. That is a dramatic line. Bring them, put them in a caravan, bring them to me. It's like, that's where you hit it hard. You know, that's the line right there. So that's kind of a natural thing, sort of thing as I'm writing. I'm already getting a hint that that is a dramatic punch there.
Finally, everything's attached to strings you can't touch. She wants so many things, and you introduce this echo. This is the outro, is you're going to use some studio trickery. But was that your idea, or was that this is one of those cases of the producer doing something?
Yeah. Dave Cook, my engineer, who actually engineered, co-produced the Rumour Reunion albums, both of them. That's when I first met him, I think. It was Struck by Lightning. I had a lot of hats to wear, and I even, you know, on the song Children and Dogs, I had to conduct children. They were too young to really understand what rhythm and punctuation means. It was very, very difficult. But I did it all, and Dave Cook would have been the guy to put on some echo there. And I would have said, yes, yes, fantastic, good idea. That's pretty much how that is.
I see, yeah. You were officially the producer. This is already past the point, 88 or whenever that was, where you said, no more actual producers, no more exactly. Other people telling me what to do.
Now I'm on my game, but for when it comes to mixing and a lot of effects, all kinds of things, EQing, that's the engineer's job. And if something feels funky to me in the wrong way, I'll say, hold on a bit, what are you doing there? But, you know, generally, you get someone you can trust, like Dave Cook and my new co-producer engineer, Tuck Nelson, who's done the last couple of albums. I'll leave them to come up with some of the subtleties of the sound and those interesting things. You throw on all that echo. It's an old trick, and it often works.
Was there a like single length, you know, an edit of this just to have, because it's so catchy. Okay, so this was already past the point where you're like, I'm not going to be on the radio. It's just fine. It's
no chance am I going to edit it. No, you got to go the whole hog with it. You got to be brave enough to stand by your insane amount of lyrics and verses and different timings. I think most of my tunes have got catchiness to them in some way or another, but that doesn't mean I'm going to try and make them into singles, because I think, oh, that's too good as it is. I'm not going to mess with a song like that. You got to tell a long story with that one. There's so much to tell.
Then finally, when, you know, you are done and we engage in this doo-doo-doo-doos or the, you know, whatever this outro is, that's when the Garth Hudson accordion really kicks in, that it's been sort of building. And it sounds like you gave him free rein to, you got a lot of verses here, build it however you like. There's not going to be a lot else going on in the background. It's just all vocals, but he's the wild card that then, oh, now we're done with the vocals. Now he can solo.
There's a bit, I remember, and he's off and running. Yes. Because a great musician like that kind of knows, oh, okay, I need to break out a little here. And he's always playing original stuff all the way through. I mean, I wasn't sitting there trying to coax him into his accordion parts, because I know jack about accordions. It's like they're a mystery to me. So you let Garth do his thing, and he's bound to come up with something like that. All those, he's off on this wild stuff, and it was perfect.
The one time I got an accordion player who like said he would play on one of my songs, was going to email me the part. He's like, oh, but you recorded in B. My accordion's not in B. You have to write it in A or something. Like, it's too late. All right.
Ooh, I got lucky there, man. I got lucky there, because once I recorded that song, I thought, oh, Garth, I've got Garth coming in. He's going to do two or three songs, and I immediately pegged him for that song. So I got lucky it was in the right key then. What do I know?
Yeah, maybe I don't even know what I'm talking about. Like, oh, that's the squeeze box. That's only in one key, but the accordion, so it's like harmonicas. You got to get a different one for each key or do a chromatic.
Oh my God. I don't. Yeah. Harmonicas are tricky things. People don't understand that a D harmonic, I've got to play it totally different from a G. And also the horn sections, when you use a horn section, they're like, yeah, that's not a good key for us. And I'm like, well, tough man. That's how I'm singing it. You know, there's certain keys that call horn sections find a lot easier. They can work their way around it, but they're comfortable with certain chords. Another thing I don't understand. I don't need to understand.
All right. Finally, I asked you pick a early career one. You picked Between You and Me from the first Graham Parker Rumor album, Howlin' Wind, 1976. But I think I read online that, in fact, this was the demo, right? It's not even the Rumor.
It's not even
that was just happened to be on that album. Yeah, say a little about this before we hear it. This is a really focused one. Less than 2.5 minutes. To the verses, a couple lines. Just get right to the chorus. Get right to the next part. Yeah.
Now, you got to remember, at the time I was writing these songs and even recording them, punk rock wasn't really a thing. People weren't doing 1.5 minute songs or 2 minute songs and going 1, 2, 3, 4. They were. It was prog rock ruled, no matter what anybody tells you. Like, oh, in 1976 in April, punk rock. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. So literally, it shows you what I actually am, this song, and that's a singer-songwriter. And that's what it is. And the reason we used the demo, and even the band agreed, when we got into the studio and suddenly I've got this backing band, the Rumor, okay, that my manager basically put around me. The songs are written, we're ready to go, I've got a record deal, and Dave Robinson brought these musicians he knew, put them together in a way, or they were sort of playing together a bit, you know, rehearsing, but not live gigging, didn't have a name. So in they came, and they obviously picked up on a lot of the intensity of songs like Soul Shoes. You know, there wasn't much of that around at that point in time. It was still prog rock land, really. You know, outside of a handful of people here and there in London or wherever. You know, 30 miles out of London, they were just discovering Uriah Heep, for crying out loud, you know. It's like suddenly your uncle would have long hair and a flared trousers in 1975. It's like, oh my God, that's all over. Please stop it. It's done. So the Rumor were playing to an intensity of those songs like You've Got to Be Kidding, which is very Dylan-esque, and Soul Shoes, and Back to School Days, which, and Don't Ask Me Questions, the intensity. So here I am playing this sweet song that they all know is good. It is good. It's a good construction. It's really a full-grown song in its own right. It's not really what we were playing like. And so the demo, me and Dave Robinson, I think, he might have said, I think the demo's better, Graham. And I'd listen. I thought, it is. It's got a perfect feel to it. And that was done in my manager's studio, which was like an 8-track.
So you just spent all this money and you're like, you know what? Let's
use the demo. You know, it happens with some people when they end up using. It's amazing the amount of artists from the 80s when the record company was saying, you've got to make good demos. Spend $100,000 on the demos. And the guy had already done demos for about $2,000. You know, a singer-songwriter, you know, a few people have talked to me and said, the demos were better, man. We spent $200,000-$300,000 on the record. We spent $50,000 on the demos, those demos, and they weren't as good as my original demos. That's one of the big mistakes of the 80s is that the more money you spend, the better the record will be. And, you know, guilty as charged, I went along with that. And you just do it because it's fashionable sometimes. But I'm long out of that fashion now, and it's the song comes first. And with Between You and Me doing that demo, the song came first. And it was just some guys who came in and played. It was natural. I played a little lead guitar on the acoustic. There's no electric lead on that song. And it's the sound of it that Dave got was absolutely, you know, just perfect. You just get that magic now and again. Whereas other demos of those days weren't as good as the Rumor, GP and the Rumor. That it just happened to be that song. And I love it. It's very atmospheric. It's not about anything in particular. It's just an atmospheric song. I guess a lost love kind of song, which creates atmosphere in the lyrics and the feel of it.
With a slightly different voice from you. You know, this is a different vocal timbre, a little lighter, some weird, you know, All I Knew Were Lights in the Haba. I don't know if you're letting yourself be more English or if this was some, do you know who you were channeling as a vocalist at this early point?
Not really. No, I had no idea. I was still being much more gruff than I would have liked when I think back on it. When I do the song now, it's so tuneful, so melodic, so pop, really, that I was still like already starting to sing in that intensity of voice that made me stand out a little bit in my own little way. But it is, yeah, man, it's a pretty song. I think sort of Somebody like Cliff Richard, I wish he'd heard it and done it, but he didn't. So, you know, I can see it by a pop singer like that, you know, who is much milder and softer than me.
The bop bop that you end with is very much in the same style as that go in there. Like, even though this is a much more kind of cool record in terms of the soul aspect, like, it's okay to do that sort of 60s pop, bop, bop. Like, we're going to have a three-part harmony bop, bop. It's not just a bop, bop.
It was very much my intention of whatever I was doing there. There was some kind of intent to go back to the days when the Beatles wouldn't throw jams into their record because they didn't have enough songs. And the Stones didn't. These bands, these pop bands, the Small Faces, you know, or whatever. Every song mattered, with a lot of the prog rock stuff, which had gone stale by now. It was very much like, oh, we can just jam five of the tunes because we've only got four. There was that plodding stuff that went on a bit after prog rock had lost its shine and ultra creativity of the earlier bands. I was trying to bring back pop music into things. Let's get a bit light, you know, silly thing. Hey, hey, this is a pop tune as well from Bowling Wind, you know.
It was great discovering in prepping for this, the Middlesex demos, 73 to 75. To hear what you were even before this point, I'm really curious. I mean, are there any surviving recordings of you playing with was it actually a prog band, or was it a whatever it is you played guitar with in your?
Oh, I joined a band in Gibraltar after I'd been in Morocco. I was like 21 or something by then, just getting on buses and going all over the country, staying places, you know, hanging with the Stoners and all that, which usually meant old Moroccan guys in jalabas and cafes. And I'd done all that, and then you run out of money, and some American cat said, oh, just go to Gibraltar, you get a job. So you go across to Gibraltar. I got a job instantly on the docks, unloading food from ships, you know. I'd go down, and there was this bar, a dive, it was like downstairs, and there were these long hairs down there, and they were Gibraltarians, and they had some instruments set up, and they were playing and doodling around, and I sort of went in the next time they were there, I think, with an acoustic guitar, and played them some stuff, and they thought, this is good, you know. We weren't playing my stuff so much, because it was very singer-songwriter. We were playing Wishbone Ash, the song Phoenix. So it was all around. We played Hey Joe, that you could make last 15, 20 minutes, you see. Well, you're noodling around over Hey Joe, which is, you know, great chords. It's not a terrible prog rock thing. But the barman in this place, every day, you'd have to be subjected to over and over again. In a garden of Vida, baby. Don't you know that I love you? Awful thing. Hideous keyboards. That's what most people were into about then in 71, 72. I guess it was prog rock was really coming on, and you get really overwrought tunes like in a Garda da Vida. I'm sure it's good in its own way. It was just that I heard it one too many times, I think, in that bar. And I introduced the band to playing things like In the Midnight Hour. For some reason, I wanted to do a Wilson Pickett song with a band that noodled. They'd never heard a song with all major chords in. You'd always have to have a minor root so you could go dwee, 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 dwee. You know, you could do a lot of dweeding and doodling.
Well, that seems to be the difference between English prog bands that were sort of more based on classical and American prog bands, which are, you know, like NRBQ or whatever, that are more eclectic and like can throw in soul and blues and, you know, funk. And Parliament Funkadelic is basically a prog band in some of its iterations. It's just the fact that you have instrumentalists that noodle. That's really what
yeah.
it comes down to.
Yeah, they picked up on the times and did, you know, psychedelic-y type of things. But NRBQ, for instance, says that they're a roots kind of band that you could call an Americana band at the same time as being wildly creative. So that it doesn't sound like ordinary, like, it doesn't sound so rootsy as a lot of things because their songwriting was so wildly creative. But, you know, you can certainly say they weren't doing, you know, King Crimson.
Fish, a band that can do literally anything and, in fact, does these, like, Halloween shows where, oh, let's play a whole band as this other, you know, just the idea of we're good enough instrumentalists, we can literally do anything.
Oh, yeah, that's great that they have an audience that accepts that as well and takes it in the stride, you know, that's good. Which they apparently do. They're very popular.
All right, well, we've gotten off the topic of you. Before we say goodbye, is there a new album in the works? What's going on right now?
No, I have. If you go to grahamparker.net and click on the tour page, you will see a bunch of solo gigs for the US of A coming up, starting at Sellersville Theatre in Sellersville, Pennsylvania on the 5th of April, I believe. That is the first solo show. And come out and see me. You never know how long this is going to last. I keep saying, well, why don't you pay, you know, 100? No, I've done it all. I've been in the trenches. I only want to do a dozen gigs a year. You know, stop going on about it. So I've done my bit. So catch me when you can. And I'm working on the set now. Always, it's always work way ahead of time. Thinking of songs that I want to do and throw in this thing and starting to maybe evolve a few jokes. Other than that, the Graham Parker and the Gold Tops with the Ladybugs 6-8 tour that we did in England, there are live tracks that two of them have been released for streaming with the Sun Valley from Last Chance to Learn the Twist as the A side, as it were. So that's out there. And there will be, I think, some more live tracks from that little tour that we did with the Gold Tops, the Ladybugs, the whole bit. I think they will be coming out because usually it's better to make a record that isn't as good as this one, because then after a month it's stopped and I don't have to do anything. You know, I made a big mistake there in doing a record that people seem to like more. And there's quite a lot of special things they're finding about. So I keep doing things like this. And now I've got to listen to some live stuff to follow, you know, to keep the ball rolling on the new record. And it's tiring, man. Can you please stop enjoying this new record of mine, everybody?
Yes, I should say that, you know, addition to the 25 albums, which I did listen to, I think all of them for this, but I did not get through the 15 plus. You got a lot of live albums or live bootlegs or whatever that are in the.
A lot. Yeah.
Well, that just, yes, hopefully people can get out to see you. I'll put your Milwaukee one on my calendar.
Solo in Milwaukee, the good old Shankle. Yeah, man. And Chicago as well, then.
Thanks so much for doing this. It was a pleasure talking to you and wandering through your catalog.
Great, man. It was a good take on things. You do good work and you do a lot of work on it. So that's quite an unusual thing in some respects. Yeah. Good, man. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
In case people have forgotten, here we are. Listen to it. Between You and Me from Howlin' Wind 1976. Bye-bye.
All I knew were the lights in the harbor. All I saw were the flash in my head, yeah. And that's all that's left between you and me, oh yeah. Say that's all that's left between you. Thing I knew I was being carried out to sea. Somebody whispering, hey, what is wrong with me? Yeah. And that's all that's left between you and me. Yeah, 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 yeah. Say that's all that's left between you. Between you and me, uh-huh, and that's all that's left between you and me, yeah, 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 say that's all that's left between you and me, uh-huh, bop, bop, between you and me, bop, bop, between you and me, bop, bop, between you and me.
Thanks so much to Graham. This one was a real treat for me. I'm a longtime fan, but had completely fallen out of touch with what he'd been doing for the last many years. Those last several albums are so good. I just think Graham is an endless font of wonderful songwriting. Really adds this soul to the singer-songwriter formula, which I think distinguishes him from just being a neo-Bob Dylan. But of course, he has the good lyrics, the thoughtful arrangements, just an excellent, excellent artist. Please see grahamparker.net to learn more. My next interview is with Paul Chastain, perhaps best known as Matthew Sweet's bass player slash harmony singer for many years, but he led his own band primarily in the 90s, a Velvet Crush, which very much hits the sweet spot for me of that neo-70s power pop thing. Great melodies, great vocal harmonies, bombastic guitars. And I've just this week recorded my first Nakedly Examining Music discussion. Now, I had done these through the Pretty Much Pop podcast, where I would occasionally get previous Nakedly Examined Music guests on that show to come back and discuss issues in songwriting. But since that show has gotten new co-hosts moved in a different direction, and I missed having these music discussions, I think at least a few times a year, I will gather three previous guests and just have them talk. In this case, we talked about writing from the head versus writing from the gut, something like that. It was a pretty wide-ranging discussion that featured Roger Joseph Manning Jr., David Christian from Comic Gane, and Rachel Taylor Brown. So all very, very smart people. Stay tuned to hear those episodes and the wonderful guests that I have planned. Make sure you're subscribed directly to the Nakedly Examined Music feed. Even if you're listening to this on the Partially Examined Live feed, you'll get your episodes promptly. Sometimes I don't even put in the auto insert ads until it goes into the Partially Examined Live feed, because that's where it gets most of its downloads. And of course, if you want a guaranteed ad-free experience, if you're using Apple Podcasts, you can just click the subscribe button that will collect some of your money on a monthly basis, or at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. You can support me there, and you're only charged there according to episodes that I actually release. So if there's a long delay, as there was before this episode, you pay nothing. So that is where I really want you all to go and just make a dollar or, you know, more if you can afford it, per episode contribution. That'll really, really motivate me to want to keep doing the show and cover my expenses. I know it seems counterintuitive to pay a podcaster when you're probably not even paying for the artists individually that you listen to now, if you're like me and just listen to everything on Spotify or another streaming service. So regarding the artists, I would, of course, advise you to get out to the shows that come to your area and, you know what, every once in a while, just give them a tip. Go on Apple Music or on their website or Bandcamp and just drop some change for the recent album or something that you're getting some pleasure out of. Really makes a big difference. And likewise with the podcasts. I do several podcasts. Some of them are more lucrative than this one. If you enjoy the show, if you listen to it regularly, I encourage you to do not take it for granted. Chuck in some change. I'm very excited because I'm going into a studio with my new, right now, 8-piece band to record our demo tomorrow. It's just 4 songs. We're going to record it all live. Certainly, it should be available for you to hear within the month. I'm super excited about this army of a band that brings together players from a couple different projects in the past and some brand new people to me. We've been working since August, getting this together, and judging on the rehearsal footage I've been capturing on my phone, it is tight. Thanks so much for listening, for hanging out with me. I hope you're doing well, keeping creative. Keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Lintzmeyer signing off.